You know, if we had somebody with cancer, we wouldn't say, you know, you could try chemotherapy, but it's pretty extreme. Instead, like, I think we should try to just eat better and use some essential oils. We would never say that.
This is Mayo Clinic on Nutrition, a podcast from Mayo Clinic, where we dig into the latest nutrition trends and research to help you understand what's health and what's hype. I'm Tara Schmidt, a registered dietitian with Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. This episode, weight bias, why and how size-based stigma seems to be everywhere, in pop culture, on the playground, even at the doctor's office, and what patients and providers can do to stop that stigma in its tracks. Weight bias is a topic that frustrates both myself and my guest, Dr. Afton Kobal. Dr. Kobal is a psychologist specializing in eating and weight disorders at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. She has done extensive research on how the perception of someone's weight can impact their medical care. Hi, Dr. Kobal.
Hi. I'm so glad to talk about this topic with you. It's always fun when we get a chance to talk.
I agree. This is not, though, a fun topic.
Yeah.
So weight bias is the term that we're talking about today. But we have all these categories, internal, external, implicit, explicit. Do you mind defining a few of those for us?
Of course, weight bias generally is defined as negative stereotypes or negative actions against people related to their weight, their body size, their body shape. And you're right, there's so many different forms. So maybe I'll start with external is sort of the messages that society may have about or actions that they take towards people of larger body sizes. And internal might be when people take those messages that our society so commonly projects. Now the message isn't coming from outside of their brain, it's them saying it to themselves. So internalizing those stereotypes and those messages and believing them about themselves, which a lot of research has suggested is really harmful. We get into implicit versus explicit, which can be important as well. Explicit is when you can kind of really see and notice some of the actions or words that people might use that are derogatory around weight or shape or size. And implicit is where it's a little bit less easy to see, more covert. And I think that that happens so often for our patients. And we probably can talk about lots of examples that will really highlight how pervasive that is.
Exactly. The worst example that I can think of is I had a patient come to me for weight management, and they told me this story about their history with weight bias. They were at a different facility. So not Mayo, but they were at maybe their original healthcare facility and had knee pain, brought it up. And the initial reaction from their provider was, you should lose weight. And I don't argue that, right? Losing weight does help our joints. But the problem with this scenario is that they brought it up more than once and they were actively losing weight and they were eating healthy and they just had a feeling this wasn't just about the weight on their joint. They come to Mayo and they have a tumor in their knee.
Wow.
That is cancer. So we're not blaming anyone, but those are the kind of stories you and I hear that just crush us, I think.
Absolutely. You just feel for people who have experienced that for a lifetime.
So in that example of the patient with the tumor in their knee, would their doctor's response be categorized as implicit external?
Probably. I mean, it doesn't sound like the provider was really outwardly making negative comments about the person's weight. They probably believed, because our society perpetuates this idea that if you lose weight, that's the big thing. If your weight is down, then your health will automatically be better. And so that has to be what is explaining this. So I agree with you. It probably was more implicit on the provider's part.
So that's an example of implicit external bias. But on the other side, when you're talking about internal bias, I kept thinking about how even when our patients have lost weight, they've been successful intentionally losing weight, sometimes they still have those thoughts. They think of themselves in their previous body shape or body size, and that's really hard for them.
Yeah, I'll have people look in the mirror and they'll say, I know when I look on the scale, I've lost X number of pounds. But when I look at myself in the mirror, I don't have this ideal body shape or size. And so I still really feel hard on myself about it, or I don't notice the weight loss as it's happened.
So we know that hundreds of years ago, having excess weight was positive. If you had excess weight, it meant that you had enough food to eat, and having enough food to eat meant that you had enough money to purchase said food. And now it's completely flipped.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea kind of where this shift came?
Yeah, I think it's really been a slow evolution of sort of cultural messages around thinness and thin being more the ideal, because you're so right, that hasn't always been the case. And certainly there are even to this day kind of cultural differences that can impact preferred body shapes and sizes. I mean, I even think about the last 10 to 30 years about how some of those preferences have changed in terms of ideal body sizes. But absolutely, there's been this slow cultural shift that has focused more for women on thinness and for men on kind of muscularity as sort of this ideal body shape and size for people. And that, interestingly, has come alongside of the global phenomenon we've seen around people's weights increasing. I don't really love the term epidemic because I think that can be really pejorative and kind of place the onus and the blame on individuals that they caused their weight gain or something like that. So we see this cultural focus and desire for thinness coupled with body sizes that are increasing. And you would think then that as our society gets larger, that there would be more acceptance around different body sizes. And that just has not been the case. If anything, there's been sort of this wider gap.
Yes. What kind of settings do your patients experience weight bias in?
Oh, yeah, there's tons of great research in this area that weight bias is so pervasive in a variety of areas. Certainly working in healthcare, we see it very often, but it happens to children in schools, from parents, from peers. It happens in the workplace. It happens pretty much anywhere that people exist.
Walking down the street.
Walking down the street. We see it in the media. We see it on TV shows, all sorts of ways and places where it occurs.
Yeah. A patient who had undergone bariatric surgery told me that more doors were being opened for them. Yeah. I said, what are you talking about? And they said, people in public now open the door for me more often.
Yeah.
I was shook.
Literally and figuratively, more doors are being opened. I hear that all the time from my patients, that it feels different being in a smaller body and that they have more access to a raise at work or to that job promotion, or dating feels a little bit different, or they get different responses from other parents at their kiddos' schools. Yeah.
Wow. Is this unique to the United States, or do we see this kind of bias in other countries as well?
It's really a global phenomenon. Some great research has highlighted that, again, there are cultural differences in terms of what body shapes are more preferred or more acceptable, but we absolutely see weight bias happening on a global scale.
Let's go into some cultural examples. Institutionally, or maybe even physically, we see bias in our environment. Airplanes, seat sizes, maybe workplaces. Do you have any examples of institutional bias?
I think you named some great ones. And I think there are really people who believe that people of larger body sizes should have to pay for two seats or should have some sort of punishment for having a seatbelt extender, those sorts of things. Absolutely. I think about even the environment I work in healthcare. I just moved into a new office. And when I started in my office there, I had my desk chair, but then there were four small chairs for my patients to sit on with arms. Yep. So certainly immediately I thought to myself how not conducive the space was to people of many sizes, right? So immediately I had to ask for different chairs that can accommodate different body sizes, because how awful would it feel for any of us to walk into a space and to automatically feel as though we're not welcome because there's a chair that won't accommodate our body. It sort of lets you know that the space and the person in that space doesn't think about you and that something's wrong with you and that you're not normal.
Absolutely.
So those sorts of spaces can be important in healthcare, of course. We think about gown sizes or exam tables that can accommodate varying body sizes, scales.
Blood pressure cuffs.
Blood pressure cuffs, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And one thing that I am proud of at Mayo is that we are actually audited for these things because we are a bariatric center. And I kind of love it because they will go around in the waiting room and make sure that there are enough larger chairs without arms. They will go to the hospital and make sure that the hospital beds, one, are big enough, but also can support the weight. It's amazing. Weight bias is all too common. Unfortunately, more than 40% of U.S. adults say they've experienced it. And, like people, it can come in many forms. Weight bias can be internal, like the disregard someone can feel for their own health or worth based on their size, or external. Weight bias can be implicit, like standard seats on an airplane that may not fit every passenger, or explicit, like a casting call for models below a size 6. People of a range of sizes can experience weight bias in the workplace, among their peers, and even alone in the mirror. It's pervasive, stemming from this cultural and systemic desire for thinness. But let's explore where exactly this bias is coming from. So we know that a lot of bias is about assumptions and false assumptions. Let's talk about some of those assumptions, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what we tend to see is that there's this idea that people who carry excess weight have excess weight because they have some sort of moral failing to themselves.
They did it.
Absolutely. If they only would have been more strong-willed, less lazy, more adherent, then they would have been able to lose the weight. But we also know that people of higher body sizes often have certain characteristics attributed to them, like less intelligent or sloppy, or even some that could be seen as more positive, but are still pretty stereotyping, like the jolly stereotype.
I was going to say funny, like the funny kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about media.
Yeah.
One example I'm aware of is in the movie Bridget Jones's Diary. The character is seen as having a little bit of excess weight. She's going to be more beautiful if she loses weight. Mm. And the weight that they show in the movie is 135.
Mm.
135 pounds. And I choose not to share my weight today, but holy buckets, people.
Yeah.
135.
Yeah.
What are other stigmatizing experiences that we see in the media?
Yeah, well, things like that, like the idea that the lead attractive person in a movie or a TV show should be thin, and that the love interest wants or prefers a thin romantic partner as opposed to people of sizes. That's not universal. I think we're getting slowly better, but it's really not the norm. You know, we'll see these kind of one-off television shows or movies that do a better job of incorporating lots of body sizes, but it's definitely not the norm. You know, we see people, again, who are kind of in these stereotypical roles where they make fun of themselves for their weight, or their weight is part of the joke. You even see that with kid actors, right? Like you see children in roles where their weight is to be made fun of, and they're supposed to be goofy or even lazy or sloppy or something like that. I see it all the time as well in reality TV shows.
Ooh.
And that's actually an area I'm really interested in that I've done a little bit of publishing in former research as well. So The Biggest Loser. I'm sure you know all about the premise, right? You bring people who have higher body weights and they go to the ranch and they work out for probably 8 to 10 hours a day. They get berated by their coaches about how terrible they are and they need to work harder. And then they lose these exorbitant amounts of weight week to week. And they weigh in every week in front of the world. And, you know, at the end, it's a competition for who can lose the most weight, essentially. So a research group that I was in my graduate training, we were really interested in how that show in particular, or kind of messages like that from reality television, might relate to people's levels of weight bias who watch the show. On the one hand, we would hear patients who talk about, you know, when I watch shows like that, I feel excited and empowered. Like if they can do it, I can do it.
Motivated.
And it motivates me. Absolutely. But then you also hear patients talk about how it's sort of discouraging and they don't love every piece of it, right? So we had some participants come into our lab setting and they watched either an hour of a Biggest Loser episode or a totally non-related TV show.
Oh my gosh.
And after 1 hour of watching The Biggest Loser, people automatically had higher beliefs about the controllability of weight, which is a form of weight bias. Again, this idea of weight being totally under our control, just eat less, exercise more, rather than being because of a variety of complex factors. And also after just an hour, the participants had higher levels of dislike of people of higher body sizes as well. So clearly those messages like you're bad, you're lazy, you did this to yourself, you didn't work hard enough, that comes through so powerfully that after just 1 hour of that, people internalize those messages.
It's so funny that you studied The Biggest Loser because I reference The Biggest Loser study often in nutrition conversations because of the metabolism research
that
we have.
Yes, absolutely.
That show's just given us more science than we thought that we
needed.
I think
so too.
Okay, so we know weight bias thrives on assumptions, false assumptions about someone's beauty, intelligence, or even their morality. Not only can these assumptions impact your social life or your chances at that promotion, their whole media empire is built on these assumptions too. Weight bias is all over pop culture, from rom-coms to reality shows. And if we do see characters with obesity, they're often portrayed as undesirable, sloppy, or the butt of some universal joke. Time and time again, we've seen characters of any size aspire to lose weight and gain admiration, even if they weigh 135 pounds. We know through research that popular shows like The Biggest Loser only reinforce this stigma in the real world. But weight bias isn't something to run from or laugh at. There are actual consequences for the stereotypes we see on TV. Let's talk about the physiological effects of weight bias and what healthcare providers and patients can do to combat it. I want to talk about the ways we see weight bias in the environment that you and I are most familiar with, healthcare. What are some of the more subtle ways assumptions can enter that space?
I was thinking about patients that I've had who are parents who have children of kind of varying body sizes and some of the judgments that they experience as well. So not only, let's say, if a parent is of a higher body size, but if their child is as well, the parent might internalize their own messages about why that's bad for their own body to be where it is, but also that they failed as a parent because they did this to their child, or they must not be feeding their child healthy foods. So I've had patients describe kind of going to the doctor with their kiddo and provider right away, starting with, okay, well, let's talk about like, what are fruits and vegetables? Not asking about what the home environment looks like, but really making assumptions. I have met patients who are so active, who eat so well. And I talk to them all the time about how we really don't know about someone's health or their health behaviors just by looking at them. Yes. But again, yet our society tells us that we do, that people of higher body sizes must eat unhealthily and must eat way too much.
They're doing something wrong.
Yes. I'm reminded of that when I see patients that I work with who describe how active they are and how healthy they eat and how much nutrition knowledge they have. So many folks that I work with are experts at this, and it's not that they don't have enough knowledge.
This is likely not their first rodeo. They are very well informed because of their history.
Yeah, and I think you're so right. It's also about not, like you said, assumptions, not assuming that because someone has a higher body weight that they should or that they want to lose weight. The structures of our healthcare system and our training models really don't support providers and helping patients feel good about their bodies at all shapes and sizes and to focus more on health rather than weight specifically.
I am very passionate as well about using people first language. And the best place that I learned this was my first year in my career. I was at a conference and someone raised their hand and asked the speaker a question that started with, when I have an obese diabetic patient, what do you think, blah, blah, blah. The speaker, I was so happy, said, stop right there. You do not have an obese diabetic patient. You have a patient with obesity and diabetes. And it was shocking to me, and I loved it. And I've been really strict with people in my life and in my job ever since.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think even the word obesity kind of has some controversy around it as well.
Sure.
And I even think, as a healthcare provider who works with people who are thinking about bariatric surgery or working on their weight or their health, so I think it was back in 2013 that obesity was classified as a disease. And for many people, that is so helpful because it, again, it takes it away from this moral failing. You know, it talks more about the biological pieces of it. The challenging side of it is what we present to the world, or what the world sees of us, is our body shape, right? And so for some people, I think it can make them feel that it means that my body is bad. My body size is a disease. So I feel a little mixed myself. I had a patient the other day who was like, tell it to me straight. I feel like what I need is for somebody to really just tell me what it is so that my motivation goes up and I can make changes in my weight. And so I sort of said, what about that would be helpful for you? And I think that this person has really internalized the message, like, we got to be hard on people, like tell them the real deal, sort of like the Biggest Loser, right? If we just give it to them straight and we're blunt and
you're in class,
you know, really direct,
then
that helps. But research has shown that that is not the case. It actually ends up reducing motivation. So I'll tell that to patients, but I'll say it to colleagues as well, because I have colleagues who feel that as well. Like, I don't want to be too sensitive, or I don't want to beat around the bush. I want to just be direct about it, and almost like a scared straight. Once patients know, then they're going to be more motivated. But there isn't any empirical support for that.
Another example I was thinking of when you were just talking was the BMI chart.
Yeah.
Behind your doctor's head, like on the bulletin board.
Yeah.
And it's green if you're normal weight, and it's yellow if you have overweight, and it's red if you have obesity. And we have enough knowledge that we do not simply focus on BMI. So I want to rip that thing off the wall because providers will point to it.
Yeah.
Like, this is how tall you are and this is how much you weigh. So you are in the red zone. And what a crush to their experience.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we're making some small strides in that area. It was just June 2023 that the AMA, the American Medical Association, came out with a statement that BMI should not be the end-all be-all metric used to define health, which I think was amazing as a first step. It's not everything, but it lets us know that the BMI charts have a lot of flaws, and they don't do a very good job at the individual level of predicting health for any one person.
When that came out, my first thought was, duh. Like, I was kind of upset that they had to make that statement.
Yeah.
I was like, who thought that that was true?
Yeah.
This is sad.
I do understand that because primary care, for example, visits are so short.
Yes.
I understand the desire for physicians or healthcare providers to have like a quick and dirty metric that they can use. And BMI has felt like that for so long.
It's free. It's fast.
Yeah. We've used it in a way that disadvantages patients and does a real disservice. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's talk more about the healthcare setting. Whenever I get asked to speak about obesity or nutrition counseling at conferences, I always put like 5 slides at the front about weight bias.
Yeah.
No one's ever asked me to talk about it. I'm like, if I get the stage, we're going to talk about this.
It's like we're level setting. We're all on the same page.
Yes. Yeah. I have this slide that has this circle on it, right? And it's patient with obesity, and providers spend less time with those patients. They spend less time counseling them on lifestyle change, because they don't inherently believe that the patient's going to do it. So now the patient only didn't have an appropriate appointment, but they had a provider who didn't believe in them. Now they are less likely to be successful because they weren't given the right tools. They're likely to not go back to that jerk. And now we're starting over, possibly even with a higher weight, opposite
Absolutely.
Of what the intention was.
Absolutely. When there's this fear that every time I have an interaction with a healthcare provider that they're going to talk about my weight, no matter what I'm there for, that feels bad. And kind of going beyond what you mentioned, they're more likely to talk about lifestyle changes than other, maybe more effective strategies for weight management. I'll give you a clinical example. I've had patients who are pursuing a transplant and they need to lose over 100 pounds. And so when their doctor only talks about diet and exercise for them, it's not the right level of intervention for the outcome that they need to have a transplant. You know, if we had somebody with cancer, we wouldn't say, you know, you could try chemotherapy, but it's pretty extreme. Instead, like, I think we should try to just eat better and use some essential oils. We would never say that. We would say, let's go right to the most effective intervention for you and your health goals. But again, because there's so much stigma around weight and this idea of it being a personal choice, it's not seen the same way.
You're a psychologist. Let's talk about the effects weight bias can have on our psychology.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I see it every day with the patients I get to work with. I see that weight bias can lead to people experiencing depression or anxiety, avoidance of certain situations like healthcare or social situations, or trying to go up for that promotion at work. It can lead to significant body image disturbance, or even extreme examples like body dysmorphia, where people develop this hatred around themselves or parts of their body. And then we see it with behaviors as well. So we can see development of eating disorders, binge eating, those sorts of things. We can see it with less motivation for physical activity, more sedentary behavior, and avoidance of things that kind of would put them in situations where they could be further stigmatized. Like, I don't want to go to the gym if I know that people are going to be making judgments about my body when I'm there. So people can avoid those sorts of situations.
What do you think we can do? So we're healthcare providers. Both of us specialize in obesity.
Sure.
What can we do to counteract these biases?
I think for all of us, the first step is increasing our awareness. That's never enough. We always have to go beyond that. But I do think because of the culture that we live in and the training that we as healthcare providers go into, we don't get enough information about weight bias. Of course, we know that when people experience weight bias, not only are they more likely to gain weight, but there's greater levels of morbidity and mortality. So it causes harm for us as healthcare providers to have weight bias. So I think the first step is awareness, and that's so important. And there are some ways that we can do that. I think there's some great organizations and other places that can offer some great training opportunities for healthcare providers. One that comes to the top of my mind is the Obesity Action Coalition. They have a number of resources for providers and for patients. They do a lot of advocacy work as well. Another great resource is the Rudd Center, which is based out of University of Connecticut. They have scripts that you can use to talk about weight in a helpful way with patients, to kind of open the door to talk about it, and then to have the conversation in a really motivating and empowering way. They also have a media gallery, because something that so often happens in our culture is that there aren't great representations of people of a variety of body sizes doing healthy things. They have an awesome free media gallery with a diverse group of patients, adults and children, that providers can use for presentations as well.
It's always a white, normal weight female eating an apple. And again, I may hit all of those categories, and that is fine, but that can't be the only person that we see that represents health.
Absolutely.
That's also how they always depict dietitians, like white women in lab coats with an apple and a scale somewhere near them.
That's funny. They probably present psychologists as like older white men with a cardigan and spectacles.
So say a provider is aware of their own weight bias and they're educating themselves. What can they do to spread awareness?
I think the next step is advocacy and coming alongside of our patients to support them in health as opposed to weight loss only. And sometimes that means advocating with them to our colleagues, you know, because we all have blind spots. It's important for us to remember it's systemic. Most of us aren't intending to cause harm to our patients or have belief systems that aren't helpful for our patients. And sometimes we have to be willing to feel uncomfortable and to challenge our belief systems in order to get better. And we have to be courageous to help our colleagues do that too.
Okay, so we've talked through weight bias on the provider's end, but what can patients do when they experience weight bias in their medical care?
It's sort of tricky because we know, as we've talked about, the systemic and cultural influences around weight bias. And so we never want to put the onus on people who are experiencing it to have to be the ones who are combating it themselves. And yet, I think if and when patients can find a provider that they connect with, that hopefully they can join with that provider to continue to advocate for their health and their appropriate care. And patients can hopefully feel empowered to share their experiences with their healthcare provider so that it's a learning moment. Sometimes we don't know that the language we're using isn't correct until it's brought to our attention. And sometimes that's most powerful when it comes from our patients.
And that goes all the way back to the beginning of that provider does not have intentional bias.
Yeah.
It's just what they have been swimming in society for a long time.
Yeah. I also wouldn't want patients to feel guilty if they don't feel comfortable talking with their provider about it, because there's a real power differential there, right?
Yeah.
And so when I have to go to my doctor and they hold the keys to my prescription that I need, you know, that makes me approach our discussions a little bit differently.
And I guess in some situations, if the patient experienced or felt as though they experienced weight bias in a clinical setting and was uncomfortable saying that face-to-face with the provider, which I absolutely understand, they could always contact that healthcare institution and share their experience. It's not tattling. We're not trying to get anyone in trouble, but that institution may take that comment and do something differently. We have a obesity bias training that all of us have to do. We have to do like our fire safety training. And what do you do in a tornado? We also have an obesity bias training.
We do. I just took it. Well, and I think about our mission at Mayo and, you know, the needs of the patient come first. And that really should mean all patients. And so I think it's so important that we have invested in making sure that the spaces that we work in can accommodate all patients, and not just accommodate, but really support and allow for excellent care of all of our patients.
Dr. Coble, I could speak to you forever. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thanks, Tara. It was really great to talk with you about this topic.
So here's what we know about weight bias. It's harmful. A doctor spending less time with a patient with obesity or simply telling them to lose weight instead of exploring underlying issues can have big risks. It can be demoralizing, depressing, and discourage the patient from returning to that provider. Weight bias can get in the way of real preventive care, and it makes providers less effective at doing their job. The good news is that there are resources available for providers to educate themselves and learn to advocate for their patients. And sometimes the most impactful lesson is when patients speak up about what they're experiencing. Awareness and advocacy are two steps anyone can take to reduce weight bias, from our workplaces and families to the medical field and beyond. That's all for this episode. But if you've got a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. We might even feature your voice on the show. For more on nutrition episodes and resources, check us out online at mayoclinic.org/onnutrition. Thanks for listening. And until next time, eat well and be well.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.